You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Ladies and gentlemen,
we invite your apprehensive listening.
How would you define the term breakthrough for yourself?
Finishing that novel, that will be my breakthrough. And this is why I like this question. So the process of editing, I love it. Because to me, that's where the magic happens. That's the real writing. Working with somebody who has great insights and who can help you be clearer and tighter and smarter. Yes, yes. But I was not at all interested in imagining my stories through a white gaze and editing for that. I wasn't going to do it. And thankfully, I wasn't asked to do it.
How would you define the term breakthrough?
I want to finish a project, and I want to someday be able to just write. Those are the ways that I feel like I can say I've had breakthrough.
What is your name?
Hello, I'm Deesha Folia, author of The Secret Lives of Church Ladies, and you're listening to the Afro Existential Podcast on the Broadway Podcast Network. To me, that's where the magic happens.
Welcome to the Afro Existential Podcast, a podcast and audio play in one. I am one of your hosts, Indira Wilson.
And I'm Blaine Van Teemer.
They're a wild lot, they say.
This season, we'll be presenting a brand new audio play entitled Pandora's Trunk and a new interview series entitled The Breakthrough, From Vision to Fruition.
In this series, we hear from people who took a great idea and made it a reality. We want to know how they did it and how they got over the obstacles along the way. We hope that it helps and inspires you to make your great idea a reality. But before we go to commercial, here's a sneak peek of our next audio play, Pandora's Trunk.
Pandora Washington is on a quest to find her birth mother. In this scene, she meets Sister Rosemary, who tries to explain to Pandora how she was seduced by the new minister of the first and last most faithful Harvest and Grains Abernethy Church.
We shall begin now.
Matthew 15:11 says, "It's not what goes into the mouth that defiles a person, but what comes out of the mouth. This defiles a person." Matthew 15:11. Lord, that what it do say. He ain't lie. He ain't lie because that's what it do say. Ha! Then Pandora, girlfriend, he did me like he did Eve. Ha! He wanted me to taste his fruit. He wanted me to taste his fruit. Let me say it one more time. He wanted me to taste his fruit. And it was a strange fruit. Oh, was it a mango or a tangela? Were it like no mango or no tangela? As far as I know, but lo, I did go. I said it was a strange fruit. And I liked it. Was it like a kumquat or a papaya or a persimmon? Said what? Like a kumquat. It was a nut. And I would be a liar if I said it was like a papaya. But oh me and oh my, I liked it. And can I get an amen? If it weren't like no persimmon. And I tell you one more again, it's the kind of fruit you want to have at night.
And we'll be right back
after a brief commercial break.
Every day I struggle with Karen. I don't want to have to struggle with my hair.
Get new and improved Afro Existential Sheen Shampoo and Reconditioner.
Ow.
It goes deep into your roots and uncovers the natural beauty that's been there all the time.
Yeah.
Every day I live the struggle. I don't want to have to struggle with my hair.
And for added protection on those Karen days, there's Afro Existential Sheen Super Holding Hairspray.
Ow.
A protein-based hairspray that holds your hair back, but won't hold you back.
I don't even have to take my earrings off. I hate to think where I'd be without it.
Afro Existential Sheen Shampoo, Reconditioner, and Relaxer. Get it today. Your roots will thank you. And that's no lie.
Ow.
Hello and welcome back to the Afro Existential Podcast and our special interview series entitled The Breakthrough, From Vision to Fruition. I am Blaine Van Teemer and I'm here with my co-host today, Frederick Johnson, and our special guest, author Disha Filial.
Disha Filial's debut short story collection, The Secret Lives of Church Ladies, won the 2021 Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction, the 2020-2021 Story Prize, and the 2020 LA Times Book Prize. The Secret Lives of Church Ladies focuses on Black women, sex, and the Black church, and is being adapted for television by HBO Max with Tessa Thompson executive producing. Disha is also a Kimberly O Fiction Fellow and will be the 2022-2023 John and Renee Grisham writer in residence at the University of Mississippi.
So we kicked off our interview by talking with Disha about breakthroughs.
What we realize is that everybody has a different definition of what a breakthrough is for them.
Sure.
And so when you think of the word breakthrough for yourself, how do you define that?
Sure. So as a writer, I've sort of seen it in two ways. First was, I want to finish something and get it published. And that something initially was a novel. There are three novels that I've started over the span of the last 20 years. And the first two, I didn't finish. Third one, I got about 2/3 of the way done, installed. And it was like, I just want to finish. And so I think if you had asked me 5-10 years ago, even, I would have said, finishing that will be my breakthrough if I can just finish it. And then I think without thinking of it as a breakthrough, but I think based on your definition, I've always wanted to be able to make a living writing. And that's been a journey as well, because like most writers or freelancers, like you're doing what I call a patchwork quilt of income. You're teaching, you're editing, you're coaching, you're taking contract jobs to cobble together enough money to pay your bills. And then you're kind of like buying time to do that book project. So I was like, I want to finish a project and I want to someday be able to just write. Those are the ways that I feel like I can say I've had breakthroughs.
What was happening internally where mm-hmm. you're like, no, I'm going to get this done by the end of this date?
As often, there's a detour. So I was, novel. I want to, this novel that I want to write. But while I was trying to get published and build a career, I was chasing any opportunity, including nonfiction, which was not, I think of like fiction as my first writing urge. There were more opportunities I found for nonfiction. And so I took this years long detour into writing about parenting, personal essay writing, and then ended up writing. My first book is actually a book on co-parenting with my ex-husband. It's a nonfiction book. And so technically, based on my original definition of a breakthrough, I broke through, but it was like, wait, revised, okay. So it's not a book. So I finished a book. I got a book published, but it wasn't the book of my heart. It wasn't.
Right.
And right. I wasn't yet able to say I make my living writing. I don't have to have these other like 50-11 jobs to pay the bills. So that was sort of the first time around. One thing I learned from that process, because I'm very proud of that book, was that in the commercial publishing world, like, you can self-publish and then you control everything. But with traditional publishing, there has to also be the marketing support that goes with the book. And either your publisher has to do it or you've got to have the money to hire a publicist and hire marketing people. And I didn't have that.
And that was for the first book.
That was for the co-parenting book. So then with this book, I was actually working a corporate job at the time when I got the deal. And so I was like, for this book, I wanted to have every chance of being successful. So I think I moved the goalposts from just finishing to actually getting it published, which I had already done, to I want people to read it.
Right.
I wanted to have every chance of success. And in this world, that means it has to be marketed. It has to be promoted. So I was like, let me try and save some coins to hire, my own publicist or something, because I don't know, it's a university press and I don't know what they're going to be able to do. My advance for Church Ladies was smaller than the advance for my nonfiction book. So I really was not anticipating that the press would be able to do much. So I was like, I gotta figure out a way. And I was researching publicists and seeing how much it would cost and, you know, trying to figure out like, what can I sell to be able to afford that? Because it's not cheap.
Right. But because and was the publicist more than the advance?
Oh yeah. Publicist, you know, was a lot more. And you pay them a stack of money and it's like, this is for 3 months. And then if you want them to keep going, it's another stack of money. But thankfully, West Virginia University Press not only saw potential in the book itself and gave me a book deal to publish it, they also invested in a publicist. They have an in-house marketing team, but then they also hired third-party publicist who is still looking out for me today, you know, you know, so people still contact him. His name is still on my website and, you know, he pushes things my way, but that made a huge difference. That made it possible for the breakthrough in that regard.
I'm going through a similar process right now where I have the book contract. Mm-hmm. And you go through all this stuff to get to that point where you're like, oh my God, I'm so excited. And then you see what the advance is.
Mm. Yeah.
And then you're like, and then it's like, wow, you have to get the publicist and the marketing, all those other things. And so many people don't know that piece,
right?
So they assume you got published, you're good to go. It's just, everything is just going to roll out and everything is going to be fine. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole machine.
That's it.
To get your book into different people's in all different kinds of ways, you know, and hopefully the advance can help with that, but it's so expensive for like a publicist. And it's like you said, it's only for a certain amount of time. And, you know, that builds a momentum. And then, okay, do I put some, it's like Vegas, right? Once you start putting those coins in.
Exactly. It's an investment. I mean, my advance would have gotten me not even a month's worth of a good publicist's time. Not even. And you can't really do much in a month. And so, you know, you were asking like how I was feeling. Once I heard that they had hired a publicist, then I got excited all over again. Cause I was like, this book could have a chance to actually be read. You know, my co-parenting book, it made its advance, it earned out. And I still get a little royalty check every quarter. So people are reading the book. And I heard from people saying, thank you for the book. But I knew that there was a lot more potential there, especially with like 50% of people getting divorced. Like there, you know, it was a huge market that we got into. So, you know, for this one, I was like, okay, this book is going to have a fighting chance. And that's all I wanted. You know, I was not feeling entitled to anything else. I would always kind of marvel and just be like a little stunned when I would hear from other writers who I saw as successful because they had published, you know, so you got 3 books. And they were like, but I didn't make this list and I didn't get this award. And I was like, oh, okay. So, you know, like you said, everybody has a different definition.
I think it's rare that we have these conversations
about
the process, right? And so we don't know as you go into it, like, do I need to ask to be put into these competitions? How much of investment are they putting into their white male authors, right? Or their white female authors? Like how much of the budget, this limited budget, is going to those particular things? Like we don't even, we don't know what questions to ask. Like we've struggled and scraped to get to that particular point.
And sometimes we're so happy to be there that we don't think we can ask questions. We don't think we can push back. Right. And Clint Smith, I just heard an interview, watched an IG Live that he did. And, you know, his book was on the New York Times bestseller list. And he wanted people to understand that, you know, it's not a pure quality of a book. There's a lot that goes into a book ending up on the bestseller list. And it's not, and it's sometimes it's dollars that the publisher push, you know, marketing, but sending it to the right people, the, you know, reviewers and which book are they championing and which competitions, all of those things are, you know, they can decide early on. This is, you know, we've got finite resources, including people resources. This is who we're going to put our weight behind this season.
Right, right.
Because of the nature of this book, did they feel like they needed to get maybe a particular type of publicist? If this was maybe different than what they've been publishing before, would that play a part at all?
I can tell you that the publicist that I have, he's not, you know, he's not Black. So it's not like he had that particular cultural, you know, competency that, you know, a Black publicist would have, but he's excellent at what he does. So I'm guessing it was because my book was the lead book. And they did with me what they did do with every author. You fill out this, what they call the author questionnaire.
Right.
And then,
right.
So I gave them a lot of information as well.
Right, right. How did you get connected with West Virginia University Press?
I have on my Black and Appalachia shirt. Uh-huh. Pittsburgh is part of Appalachia. And West Virginia University Press is a regional press. And so head of the press actually lives in Pittsburgh now. I don't know if he did several years ago, but he connected with my agent. And I don't know, probably maybe they were just at a conference or just knowing each other, being in the region together. And while I was working on my collection, before we sent it out, my agent had coffee with him just to, you know, like a get to know you type of thing. And she mentioned what I was working on. And he said, oh, you know, that would be something I would be interested in taking a look at. And so, you know, the interest was sparked there. And then, so when we had, we went out with a partial manuscript and he was, you know, the West Virginia was among the publishers that we sent it out to, and they are the only offer that I got. Everybody else rejected it.
Wow. That's the only one you needed.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
Misha, so how did this book come about and how long did it take you to write it? The nine stories.
Yeah. So at this point, what is it, 2022? The oldest story in the collection is probably 7 years old at this point. But, you know, I had mentioned that I was writing a novel that I started in 2007. The main character of that novel is a church lady. She's actually a first lady, the pastor's wife of a mega church. So I had that novel, but then I stalled, but I started working on these short stories. And I was reading them at different events. And my agent is also local. And she would, you know, had heard me read some of these stories. And so she said, you know, while you're on hiatus from the novel, you know, maybe you could build a collection around these church lady stories. And so she was the first to use that phrase. I wasn't really thinking of them that way. I didn't, because I only had like two at the time, but she saw the connections there. And so she encouraged me to get intentional about writing stories that centered around the theme of Black women, sex, and the Black church, which is pretty broad. And not that building a collection is easy, but certainly I felt like I could do that. It felt more possible than finish this novel that I had just been dragging around at this point almost a decade. And she also was very specific in that once I got three stories published, she felt that we could go to market with a partial manuscript. And that felt tangible and it felt possible. Yeah. And, you know, it gave me a clear assignment, whereas finish the novel just felt overwhelming. I got going and started writing and submitting. And while things were out, I was writing some more. And so it was in that mix that she had the conversation with him. So by the time we submitted, the partial manuscript actually had six stories in it. Three of them had been published.
You said three of the stories had been published. Were they like in different anthologies and different?
Not anthologies. Apogee Journal, Baltimore Review, and the Cheat River Review were the first, were the places that published the three of the stories from the collection before it became a collection.
But going from that such a broad theme, how did you kind of drill down from that theme?
So I had some stories that I had started before I knew I was building a collection. I was always working on something. And by started, sometimes it's 20 pages. Sometimes it's a sentence. Sometimes, you know, it's a line of dialogue that I hear that I come back and develop it. And so I had all of these, you know, like story possibilities. And I revisited them through a lens of that theme, Black women, sex, and the Black church. When I sat down with my agent, and she's now what I now know is an editorial agent. So she doesn't just get the deals, but she also, she was an editor before she was an agent. And so she edits my work as well before I send it out into the world. And so I had a couple dozen possibilities and I just laid them all out. And some of them didn't even have titles. And I just tried to describe them in one sentence, you know, what I thought the story was going to be. So she and I kind of went through those and narrowed it down to maybe like 12 or 15. And I know myself, which is I would have obsessed forever over which other stories, and this is after I got the book deal to, you know, to, you know, I knew what I needed to do. I needed to keep writing. I would have like, well, which is the perfect story and which is the best? And I would have worried myself until I was paralyzed. So I took 12 of those stories and I reached out to like maybe 6 friends of mine, some of whom, you know, read my work before I send it out, and others just people who I thought had good eyes and good ears. And I said, which of these stories, your top 5, tell me your top 5. After I heard back from everybody, 5 stories kind of got the most votes. And I was like, that's it. These are the stories I'm going to write. And so what West Virginia did was they didn't tell me how many more stories to add. They just said, we want a collection of about 35,000 words. And so I had the 6 stories. I took one of those stories out because I felt like it wasn't a great fit. I also didn't feel like it was a particularly strong story. And I also wasn't interested at that point in going back and working with it. So I pulled it out. So I had 5 stories and then in the collection already. And then I just started writing through my top 5 until I hit that 35,000 mark. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't very scientific, I can't say. And the stories that were added, you know, what it accomplished was multiple generations, you know, they're intergenerational stories. There's some stories that are really heavy and then others that also have some humor. I got to play with form. And so I tried not to think about, is this redundant or is this cohesive? I just tried to look at the stories before me and just fall into them and just see, you know, well, what's possible. Story like When Eddie Levert Comes, initially that was a story about what happens when a parent who wasn't a particularly good parent to you, you've now got to take care of them. So there also wasn't a lot of anything around the church initially in that story. But when it was time to build the collection, I had the mother have a conversion experience. So there's, you know, the mother before she became a Christian and the mother afterwards. And that became a big part of the story.
What I enjoyed about that story and felt like I knew that person, mm-hmm. she had the conversion experience, but it's like it didn't translate into a certain type of unconditional love or kindness toward right. that daughter, especially. Right. So I was always kind of like, okay, where's your Christianity when it comes yeah. to this? But it's very common.
And it kind of reflects, you know, my experience growing up where the sinner's prayer, you know, you say the sinner's prayer and that's what makes you a Christian. And there's this belief that it's the Holy Spirit that moves and creates that moment and brings you to Christ and all of those things. And I know my own conversion experience was, I had to list church membership on time. I grew up in the South. You know, you could be doing something secular and they still want to know what church you belong to. And there was some organization that wanted to recognize Black students who were doing well. And I filled out my little card at school and was turning it in. And this other kid saw my card and it said under church affiliation or whatever, I wrote various because I was going to various churches. And he laughed at me. Oh, he laughed so hard. It was a Friday. I'll never forget. And I asked the school administrative assistant, I said, can I bring this back on Monday? And she said, yes. So I had been going to my grandmother's church on my dad's side. I marched right up there when they had the altar call and I said that sinner's prayer so that I wouldn't be lying on Monday. When I wrote Abyssinia Missionary Baptist Church on that card and turned it in. And I did not have a conversion experience, you know? And so I think, unfortunately, you know, people do that for lots of reasons. And so my character, maybe she did have a heartfelt experience, but it was more the, I'm trying to get right. I'm yeah. trying to get right. And people say that and they're trying to get right, but there's so much that goes untouched, like yeah. you said. So if you take a story like Dear Sister, that's a story about family and about these sisters.
Dear Sister. Dear Jackie, I've started this letter about 5 different times in 5 different ways. Finally, I just told myself, you're either going to read it or you're not. And it's not going to come down to how I write it. It's all about who you are and what you've been through and what, if anything, it means to you to share a father with my sisters, Renee, Kimba, Tashita, and me. Maybe it means nothing. Maybe your life has been just fine without our father in it, which I hope is the case. Maybe it means everything. And you've longed to know him and struggled because you didn't. Either way, You have a right to know that our father, Wallace Stett Brown, died last week of a massive stroke. As far as we know, you never met our father. The last time he saw you, you were an infant. If that's the case, and if it's any consolation, you didn't miss much. Tashita, our baby sister, wanted me to tell you that. We were all sitting around at Grandma's house, and everyone is talking at once, telling me what I should write to you. You know, I'm mostly ignoring them. They picked me to write this because I shoot straight and don't mince words. But I also have tact, unlike Tashita. Oh, and in case you're wondering, we always just called at Grandma's house. Even though Granddaddy lived here too when he was alive. He died of a heart attack in 2002. God rest his soul. You would have loved him. Everybody did. Always had a joke or a funny story to tell. Ooh, he was good people, just like Grandma. They lost their kids to the street or hard living, one way or another. Even though they tried their best to raise them right. But some people just go their own way, you know? Anyway, back to Stett. Tashita is right. You didn't miss much. Stett, well, everybody called him Stett, except for Grandma because he wore a Stetson in high school. Stett wasn't much of a daddy. Each of us girls had a different kind of relationship with him. None of them healthy. And none of them what we needed it to be.
It's interesting to grow up in a household with siblings. And as adults, everybody had a different experience.
Yes. Right. Yes. So I, my life is like Dear Sister. My mother's only child, but my father has five daughters. And there was a fifth sister that four of us knew about growing up. We were never around her. We didn't get to know her. And someone said, when our father died, like, you guys should contact her. And the four of us called her on speakerphone, which is, you know, horrible to do to somebody, like, hey, he's dead, but we're your sisters. Because Dear Sister story is in epistolary form. And so it was an opportunity to do that right. You know, it should have been a letter, but it was also an opportunity for me to create this world of sisters that I didn't have, because I had my sisters, but we didn't grow up like that. And I wish that we could have been fighting and all of that, you know, the good and the bad and all of it in between, but we really didn't have that. And so I got to imagine what that was like.
You didn't grow up because of the age difference?
Well, I mean, so the three sisters that I, you know, knew about growing up, two of them also have the same mother, and they always lived somewhere else, and there was other stuff going on there. And then my other sister, our mothers decided to kind of raise us like sisters, right? Like the sisters we are, meaning right. That she, you know, I'd spend the night at her house, she'd come to mine. There's a 3-year age difference, but we weren't in each other's lives as much as I wish we had been. Mm-hmm. But but that one sister, our mothers initially, when my sister was born, because I was 3 years older, they were going to like fight and all this. And then they were like, wait a minute, we're going to fight over this guy? No, you know. And they knew, and they told us the story from the time we were little, that they knew that he wasn't going to be around and they weren't going to be around forever, and we would need each other. And so I was, you know, connected with that sister in that way.
I think there's a large part of, like, we're not supposed to talk about what's going on in our families outside of the family, right? So there's a whole lot of secrecy around that, mm-hmm. which then may lead you to therapy as an adult, right?
Hopefully.
And then it's like, as you get older, you start having these conversations with other people. I think because we don't get to write that many stories like this, mm-hmm. we see church women in one particular way.
Somebody reached out and said, I love these stories because it reminds me of the church women who, as soon as church was out, they'd walk across the street to smoke a cigarette. I had never seen that before, but I think it's a perfect image. As Walt Whitman said, we contain multitudes. You know, we are complex. We are nuanced. We are not we don't fit neatly in the binaries that church often wants to put us in, including church women. And so there's so much to who we are.
And we'll be right back.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. Suf's The Original New Musical from Shana Taub is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com.
Hello, I'm Alistair Justin Black from Theatre in the Black. Playwright Blaine Teamer began writing Dead Weight in 2016. He finished it nearly 4 months later. The writing of The Perfect Line in a Great Play, or the making of a line of fine, fancy wines, takes time. Perfect example is Afro Eggs' new and improved Bougie Beaujolais, a red wine with notes of tang, green apple, tropical punch, black cherry, and invisible grape. It's a fancy wine for those fancy moments. What was true nearly 4 months ago is true today.
It's 5 o'clock somewhere.
Take life one sip at a time.
We are so glad you joined us for another episode of the Afro Existential Podcast. And take a moment to visit us at our website, afroexpodcast.com, for more fun and insightful content.
Anything else?
Please click subscribe.
And visit us at Instagram at the Afro EX Theater.
Look at that. Look at that.
Anything else?
Email us your comments or questions at afroexpodcast@gmail.com.
Exactly.
And a special thank you to our guest, Disha Filial. And you can find out more about Disha and her book, The Secret Lives of Church Ladies, at her website, DishaFilial.com. That's DeeshaFilial.com.
Anything else?
Again, thank you for joining us. And as always, have a great day on purpose. The Afro Existential Podcast is part of the Broadway Podcast Network.
Going on now.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Suffs. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Suffs celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Suffs has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.